I know that if you're listening to this podcast, that you have undoubtedly at least heard of the controversy around Colin Kaepernick and taking a knee during the national anthem. And there were many people who opined, including law school students and even a couple of legal scholars, that he had a First Amendment right to do that. In fact, in one article, University of Baltimore Law Review, on their website, article by a second-year law school student, he said, "Fellow professional athletes had expressed solidarity with Kaepernick's protest and expression of his First Amendment right to free speech. The only problem is the First Amendment doesn't apply." You see, the First Amendment, along with the rest of the first 8 amendments to the United States Constitution, only apply to government action. And that's what we're going to be talking about in this podcast today. Welcome to Broadcast Blue.
Bringing you the latest case law updates on the legal aspects of law enforcement. This is Broadcast Blue.
The case of the Mad Mama. The case I've selected for this week's case of the week is United States versus Heibel. And this case comes to us from the 8th Circuit, and the decision was released on the 6th of July of 2018. This is the 18th edition in 2018 of Bruce's Brown Bag Wednesday. Let's take a look at the facts in this case. In February of 2015, the Sioux Falls Police Department received a call from a young boy. It was a domestic disturbance call, and this young boy reported that a man was harassing his mother. The police responded to the scene, and upon arriving at the scene, Officer Mattson was flagged down by Michelle Janice. And Janice is the mother of the boy who placed the call. Officer Mattson asked her what was going on, and she responded, and this is a quote from the case, "I wanted to sign a complaint on him." And she was identifying and referencing the defendant in this case, Heibel. She said, "He went and had pictures of my daughter naked, and she's only 13. So her complaint is that her daughter, her 13-year-old daughter, that this person has nude images of her on his cell phone. Janice informed Officer Mattson that the red Ford Taurus, there was a red Ford Taurus in the driveway that was running in front of her building, and that it belonged to Heibel. A license plate check revealed the Taurus was registered to Heibel, but he listed Janice's address as the address for his residence for the registration. Janice entered the vehicle without being told to do so. She goes into the car, and when she goes in, Officer Mattson asked her if she was going to grab the keys. Although she said yes, she turned the car off but left the keys in the ignition, and then she went back and reapproached Officer Mattson on the sidewalk in front of her apartment and explained that she and Heibel had been arguing several days earlier because she refused to let him see their daughter. They had an infant daughter together. It was during the argument, she said, that she looked at Heibel's phone and saw the naked pictures of her 13-year-old daughter, who was not related to the defendant, Heibel, in this case. And at that point, Officer Mattson asked her, "Do you have the phone?" And without any explanation and without being told to do anything by the officers, she began walking back towards the Taurus and stammered, "I don't know if it's this. I think he does have one. He probably got rid of it or whatever." She then re-entered the vehicle just as Officer Mattson's backup arrived, and then the backup officer and Mattson conferred several feet away from the Taurus for about half a minute, 30 seconds, as Janice was inside the vehicle. Officer Mattson later testified that he never directed Janice to enter the Taurus or to look for the phone, that he himself neither opened nor entered the car, and that his attention at the time she was in the car was on the backup officer while she was in the vehicle. After her very brief time in the Taurus, that 30 seconds, Janice emerged with Heibel's cell phone and handed it to Officer Mattson. She explained that there were nude photos of her daughter on the cell phone, but she couldn't find them because they were, in her words, deeper in the phone. When Officer Mattson could not find the pictures, Janice became upset, worrying that nothing was going to be done. Officer Mattson explained that he could not make an arrest solely based on her statements, but that he would take the phone for further investigation. A subsequent forensic analysis was conducted pursuant to a search warrant, and it uncovered the images. Heibel was later charged with one count of sexual exploitation of a child, and before trial, through his defense attorney, he filed a motion to suppress all the evidence obtained as a result of what he described as an illegal search of his vehicle. You knew that was coming. The defense attorney, that's not fair, going to argue that it's an unlawful search so they can get the exclusionary rule to kick out that evidence. Among other things, he argued that the Fourth Amendment applied to Janice's search of the Taurus because she was acting as an agent or an instrument of the government. The district court referred the motion to suppress to a magistrate judge who conducted an evidentiary hearing, issued an R&R, a report and recommendation, concluding that Heibel did not establish Carrier's burden of showing that Janice had acted as a government agent. The R&R adopted the defendant Heibel's position that Officer Mattson acquiesced to the search and had a pretty good idea that she was going to look for the phone, but there was no evidence suggesting that Janice was motivated primarily by the desire to help the police. Heibel subsequently entered into a guilty plea and reserved the right to challenge the admissibility of the evidence under his motion to suppress, and he was sentenced to 300 months imprisonment, and he appealed the conviction, arguing that the district court erred in finding that there was no Fourth Amendment violation in Janice's search of his vehicle. So I started the very beginning of this episode of Broadcast Blue with the concept that the person taking a knee, Colin Kaepernick's taking a knee, was not constitutional. And if the NFL told him he could not do that, it would not be violating his constitutional rights. And you were probably wondering to yourself, self, what in the world does that have to do with Fourth Amendment cases? And it has a lot to do with this case, in as much as it's a fundamental concept and one that we don't talk about all the time, but it's a very underpinning of the application of the first eight amendments, including the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution, and that is it only applies to government action. It does not apply to purely private action. And so what a private actor does, if done by a government actor or if done at the direction of the government, may very well be considered government action. But when it's done on their own and it's not, the primary motivation is not to help the government or specifically help law enforcement, then it does not constitute government action for the purposes of the Fourth Amendment. Now, and for the purposes of the applicability of the Fourth Amendment. So if it's not, if what someone does is not a search under the Fourth Amendment, then it doesn't have to be reasonable under the Fourth Amendment, which means you don't have to have a warrant or one of those JREs, one of those judicially recognized exceptions. But if it is a search or a seizure under the Fourth Amendment, then it has to be reasonable under the Fourth Amendment. So the basic concept here and the fundamental argument is the government's arguing that what Janice did not constitute a search because it was purely private action. It was not done at the direction and primarily to benefit the government. And the defense is arguing that it did and that it was government action, and therefore the Fourth Amendment is applicable. And it can get kind of tricky. Sometimes it's very straightforward. Look, if I was, let's say I was the manager of an Ace Hardware store, and let's say I watch Cops all the time on TV. Now I'm watching live PD on TV, and I've been doing it for so long, I'm practically trained law enforcement at this point. I think, you know, hey, I know what's going on. I've been watching so many hours of this. I know the drill. And my next door neighbor, I get a new neighbor, and he moves in, and he's got this strange light aglow up in an upstairs bedroom, and I say to myself, and it's on 24/7, and I say to myself, self, that guy's growing some dope up there. He's got a Maui Wowie going on up there in that bedroom. I've seen this on a few episodes of Cops. I know what's going on here. And I noticed my neighbor hiding a key in one of those little fake rocks by his front door one day. He bought the rock and the key down at my Ace Hardware store. I saw him do it. And he goes off on vacation, and I go over there, And I take that key out of that fake rock and I open the door and I go up to that bedroom. And when I go in there, I find a whole bunch of marijuana and I grab a plant and I take it down to the police station and I say, hey, look what I found in my neighbor's house. That is not a search. My actions are not a search under the Fourth Amendment. I was not directed by law enforcement to do that. And indeed, they had no idea that I was even going to do it. I did it all on my own as a result of the episodes that I saw on Cops. That is not a violation. I have not violated my neighbor's Fourth Amendment rights because I can't, because I'm not a government actor. Now, I'm not saying it's okay. In fact, it's criminal. What I did was breaking and entering, and I can be held accountable for that, as well as being in possession of the marijuana plant when I show up at the police station. I'm not saying it's okay. I'm just saying it's not a constitutional issue. So the fundamental thing that we often skip over, but need to consider every once in a while, and this is a good case for it, is the whole concept of whether or not the action was done by or on behalf of the government as to implicate Fourth Amendment scrutiny. Before we take a look at what the circuit court's analysis was with this issue on appeal, let me talk first to give you a couple quick little legal blasts from the past. Now, the first one, and it's the obvious notion, and the whole concept is that if evidence is seized from a vehicle as a result of an illegal search, then it's going to be suppressed. And a cite for that is the Wong Sun case, Wong Sun versus United States, 371 U.S. 471, a case from way back in 1963. But the main legal blast from the past that's going to be applicable for us in this particular case is Skinner versus the Railway Labor Executives Association. Now, this case comes from, it's a 1989 Supreme Court decision, and fundamentally, this case stands for the proposition, to quote the case, the Fourth Amendment does not apply to a search or seizure, even an arbitrary one, effected by a private party on his own initiative. But it does protect against such intrusions if the private party acted as an instrument or agent of the government. So like I said earlier, it has to be government action. It doesn't have to be a government actor. It can be a non-government person who is acting as the agent, acting on behalf of law enforcement, of the government. So if you have a confidential informant, you can't direct a confidential informant to do something that you can't do yourself. I mean, if you direct a confidential informant to break into someone's house and look around and go beyond the point to which they have a license to enter and the consent, then you're at a situation to where the confidential informant is doing that as a government as a government agent, doing it at the direction of the government. It's possible that that a private party, an individual, can conduct a search that would be a Fourth Amendment search, except for the fact that they did it on their own initiative and not primarily with the primary intent of benefiting law enforcement. So that's the primary legal case, and that's the case that the court referred to in this particular case in the Eighth Circuit, and it's important to understand that as a baseline. Again, sometimes we skip over it, and we just think this is obvious. Everyone has these constitutional rights and protections, and we kind of forget, at least on occasion, that these first eight amendments, including the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution, apply to government action. So the answer to the question presented in this case is going to turn on whether Janice, as a private party, would be deemed an agent or an instrument of the government for Fourth Amendment purposes. And that's the significant part. That's the question to be answered. And the Eighth Circuit said that this turns on the degree of the government's participation in the private party's action. And this question has to be resolved in light of all the circumstances. So again, it's another one of those totality of the circumstances situations. In evaluating whether or not the private action is government action under agency theory, and you know, whether this person acted as an agent of the government for Fourth Amendment purposes, the Eighth Circuit in its previous decisions has focused on three relevant factors. The first factor is whether the government had knowledge of the action and acquiesced in the intrusive conduct. The second one is whether the citizen intended to assist law enforcement or instead acted to further his own purposes. So what's the primary purpose there of what they're doing, why they're doing it? And third, whether the citizen acted at the government's request. And so those are the three prongs, if you will, to this test that the Eighth Circuit, or the three factors the Eighth Circuit uses to determine whether when a private person does something, they are doing it as an agent of the government for Fourth Amendment purposes. So the Eighth Circuit applied this three-factor test in order to answer the question of whether or not this private action constituted government action for Fourth Amendment purposes. And they looked at the first factor that deals with whether or not the officers had knowledge and acquiesced to the activity, in this particular case, Janice's entry into the Ford Taurus. And the court said that if you look at this factor, it's in favor of the defendant, in this case, Heibel, because the district court adopted the R&R's determination that Officer Mattson knew and acquiesced to her search of the Taurus. Even though his attention was directed somewhere else, he knew she was going into the vehicle. And the government conceded that fact. The court then skipped to the third factor regarding whether the government requested the challenge search, and the court noted that they did not. And this cut against the conclusion that you reach with the first factor, kind of nullifies the first factor. The district court adopted the R&R's finding that Mattson did not ask or compel Miss Janice to conduct the search. Heibel attempted to challenge the determination on appeal by suggesting that when Officer Mattson asked the question, "Do you have the phone?" that necessarily implied a request to search Heibel's car. And the court said, although Mattson acknowledged that he made this inquiry in hopes of securing the phone, the district court did not clearly err in concluding that the question did not encompass a request or a demand for her to search the Taurus. Rather, he merely inquired as to whether Janice had the phone in her possession. So the third factor works against, the court says, cuts against finding of agency in this case, which works in favor of the government. So now the court went to the second factor. It looked at factor one and factor three, and then they kind of nullified. The way the court looked at it, they kind of nullified each other. He didn't ask her to do it, but he knew that she was doing it. And so now the second factor, the factor is going to be dispositive. And the question is whether Janice intended to assist law enforcement or instead acted to further her own purposes. Even when government officials know of and acquiesce in a warrantless search, at least in the Eighth Circuit, the Eighth Circuit's been unwilling to impute agency where the private actor was not motivated solely or even primarily by the intent to aid the officers where the government did not request the challenge search. So what the court's saying is that when they, just because they know that the search is taking place and they acquiesce to it, if they didn't request it and the primary intent of the person was not to aid law enforcement, then it will not be a search under the Fourth Amendment. So the getting down to the nitty-gritty, this is all going to revolve around what the primary, Janice's primary purpose of searching the vehicle was, and the primary purpose of going into the vehicle. The court held that while Janice undoubtedly aided Officer Mattson by retrieving the phone, there was no evidence suggesting that she was motivated primarily by a desire to help police. And the court talked about the concept of mixed motives. Even if it's a mixed motive, even if they have a motive, they have personal motive to conduct the search, and they also have the motive of helping the police, unless the motive of helping the police is primary, even in a mixed motive case, it will not make it a search under the Fourth Amendment. And the court noted that she had all kinds of personal interest in conducting the search. She wanted to protect her 13-year-old daughter. She wanted to ensure that justice was done. And although that might imply that you need law enforcement, she certainly wanted to make sure the evidence wasn't lost. She wanted to make sure that it wasn't disseminated, that they weren't spread around further. And so she had all kinds of, had multiple personal interests in in making this search and conducting the search of the vehicle. And there was nothing in the record to suggest that her primary motivation was to assist the police. And since that was not, at least there wasn't any evidence to prove that that was her primary purpose, then it was, at best it was a mixed motive, but that not being a primary purpose, then the court said that this was not government action for the purposes of applying the Fourth Amendment. So there you have it, United States versus Heibel, the Eighth Circuit decision from just a few weeks ago. Very significant, and it helps to demonstrate that whole concept of government action. Can you change the facts a little bit and make this government action? Sure you can. If Janice had taken the stand in the suppression hearing and said that her primary motivation was to help the police, this probably would have gone a different direction. And just because... So it's important to show that just because officers know and acquiesce to certain action doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to constitute government action. You have to look at those other factors, if especially if they're not directed to do it. Now, clearly, if an officer directs someone to do something that would be Fourth Amendment action if they did it themselves, then that's going to kick in the whole concept of being an agent of the government, and it's going to be a Fourth Amendment search. You're not going to be able to circumvent the Fourth Amendment requirements on you as a law enforcement officer by directing a non-LEO to do that which you couldn't do under the Fourth Amendment. That's pretty much clear. You're not going to do what often referred to as a workaround. You're not going to work around the Fourth Amendment. And but you have to, sometimes the government isn't involved to the extent necessary to implicate the Fourth Amendment. And this case is a pretty good indication of where that line is drawn and how you determine when it gets a little gray. You have to apply those factors, and you have to look to see whether or not the personal action, private action, constitutes government action for Fourth Amendment purposes. Now, you're probably wondering, if you've tuned into any of these webinars before, you're probably thinking, well, what about that? What about the seizure? You know, if you line up the Fourth Amendment dominoes here, and these were not issues on appeal, and so it's not discussed. It's only referenced one time in the entire case. What about the seizure of the phone when he took it? The whole question on appeal was her entry into the vehicle when she went and got the phone. She took the phone. She went into the car, which was a search. Not a Fourth Amendment search because it's private action. And she took the phone and she seized the phone, although it wasn't a Fourth Amendment seizure because, again, it was private action. But then she handed it to the officer, and the officer went through the phone looking for the images, and he couldn't find them. So he searched the phone once she handed it to him, and he didn't find anything. He didn't find any images. But what if he had? Would Riley v. California have kicked in some form at that particular point? And what about when it was searched at the lab? It's important to note, and if you look at the lower court decisions, the district court decisions, it's clear they obtained a warrant. There was a warrant that was obtained. There were some challenges that were made in the lower court that were not presented on appeal to the Eighth Circuit. But based, what about when he seized the phone? When the officer first sees the phone, well, he had probable cause that the object that was in his hand was the container for contraband, and he seized it. He had access to it because she handed it to him, and he had probable cause that there was contraband on it based on what she had told him, and so it was a seizure based on the fact he had probable cause, and it was right there in his hand. And what about the search when he went through that? Of course, and I briefly talked about that for a few seconds ago, the whole concept of when he searched the phone after he had seized it, should he have had a warrant to do that? And if he had found images when he did that without the warrant, we might have had a different issue on appeal in this case. But he didn't find anything, and he went and they got a warrant, and then they did a forensic search of the device pursuant to the warrant, and it was found under the warrant. And so all of that was resolved down at the district court level. But if you were wondering, hey, we've got some dominoes that are missing here, some Fourth Amendment dominoes to line up before we get to that question, then you're absolutely right. There were. And that was all resolved at the lower court level and was not an issue on appeal in this case. Well, that's it for this edition of Bruce's Brown Bag Wednesday webinar. Thank you so much for joining me on this, whether you're joining me on the podcast, you're watching on our Vimeo channel, or you tuned in live as a webinar participant, which I always invite you to do that as well. You can find out more information about all of Broadcast Blue podcasts and webinars and videos at www.broadcastblue. It makes it really easy when your website address is your name. We are Broadcast Blue, and you just put a dot, broadcast.blue, and you type that in your URL block in your browser, and Bob's your uncle. There you go. You're on our website. We have podcasts. There are more than just Bruce's Brown Bag Wednesday. We do the Supreme Court update specials. We've got the Blue Key specials, the Blue Key cases coming out here pretty soon. We also have the Broadcast Blue shorts. Very short little video cases on updates. The Blue Blog, where we do quick summaries and links to the full decisions of these cases as they come out. Videos on our Vimeo channel that you can also find. There's a link to it on broadcast.blue, and the Vimeo channel is brownbag.video. You can either get there directly or go through Broadcast Blue. And don't forget, while you're on the Broadcast Blue website, sign up for that Broadcast Blue newsletter for periodic updates and information impacting the legal aspects of law enforcement. Please subscribe to the Broadcast Blue podcast on Google Play and iTunes. And thank you so much for joining me. And I hope to see you again real soon here on Broadcast Blue. This edition of Broadcast Blue was brought to you by Leah One. Leah One specializes in providing training, teaching the legal aspects of law enforcement through on-demand e-learning courses, live webinar training, live instruction at your site, or live offerings at central sites throughout the country. For information, please go to www.leah.one. This presentation is provided for purely academic purposes. I'm fond of saying I'm a lawyer, but I'm not your lawyer. And what I mean by that is that I do not provide formal legal advice through these presentations. No part of this presentation is offered, nor should it be construed as legal advice. If you need formal legal advice regarding any part of this presentation or have legal questions, you should consult with your attorney.